Brought to you by the Royal Society of Chemistry, this is the Chemistry World Podcast.
Hello, and welcome to the November edition of the Chemistry World Podcast, with Matt Wilkinson, Nina Notman, and Anna Lucock. In this month's show, we explore how to make a protein do exactly what you want.
So one of the ideas that we like to play with is the idea that we could take a generic scaffold, a shape of protein that is found quite widely in nature, and then decorate it in a way to give it lots of different functions according to what you want it to do.
Mastering the art of synthetic biology, Ben Davis will be explaining how this technology could be used for earlier diagnosis of diseases such as multiple sclerosis and even brain tumours. Also on the way, the potential for the ultimate spy car.
You could imagine military applications whereby you would try to create paints that you could switch a camouflaging effect on or off, or maybe even sort of in spy cars and creating paints of the future for the next James Bond car.
Matt Wilkinson will be investigating how an understanding of squid biology has led to this possibility for the next Bond car. Plus, we meet one of this year's Chemistry Nobel Prize winners, to find out about the work that led to this award and just how it feels to be recognised with such an honour.
Sort of overwhelmed. It's great. But the really exciting part for me was the days we were able to peer into the centre of the ribosome and see this amazing structure that we had no idea what it was going to look like.
Nobel laureate Tom Steitz will be discussing his work on the structure and function of the ribosome. That's all coming up on this month's Chemistry World Podcast.
The Chemistry World Podcast is brought to you by the Royal Society of Chemistry. Look us up online at chemistryworld.org.
First this month, we pop open some bubbly, as scientists have been exploring the chemistry of champagne bubbles. Sounds like fun, doesn't it, Anna?
Absolutely. We've got researchers from France and Germany who've been analysing champagne bubbles to unravel their molecular makeup. They've borrowed a technique from oceanography. So if you imagine the rolling ocean waves with their white crest of foam and bubbles as they crash to the surface, oceanographers have studied that ocean fizz and found that air bubbles that were trapped during rough sea conditions, when they burst, they found that the concentration of certain molecules in the aerosols that were released had certain molecules at a concentration much higher than would have been in the bulk ocean. So a few years ago, scientists thought that perhaps there might be some similarities between that ocean fizz and champagne fizz.
So who has been looking into this, and how did they go about then analysing the fizz of champagne?
So it's researchers from France and Germany, led by Gérard Ligier-Belair, and they use a very simple technique, really. They used ultra-high-resolution mass spectrometry to look at the molecular profile of tiny droplets that burst in the air above the surface of sparkling wines. And they did this by holding a microscope slide over a champagne glass. They then rinsed that with methanol and transferred the solution to the spectrometer.
And so what did they find?
They found that the concentrations of some molecules in that aerosol were up to 30 times higher in the aerosol than in that bulk liquid, and the bubbles had much higher concentration of surfactant-like molecules. Now, that isn't entirely surprising because those kind of molecules kind of feel at home on that air-water interface. The water-soluble head can sit in the wine part while the hydrophobic feet are safe in the air within the bubble.
Knowing this now, how have they then investigated or found out more about the experience of drinking sparkling wine?
One of the surprising things that they found was the number of flavour molecules within the aerosol. The chemistry of wine is very complex, so when the team compared their results with data about compounds that are known to contribute to wine flavour, they found a whole range of aroma and flavour molecules that get released when these bubbles burst and the aerosols are released. And as the bubbles burst, those molecules are carried to your nostrils. And given that we know that aroma and smell plays a contributing role in our taste, these aerosols do play a role in our experience of drinking champagne.
OK, well, thank you, Anna. And from sparkling champagne now to shiny proteins. And we're looking at iridescent squid, Matt.
Yes, indeed, Mira. Alison Sweeney at the University of California in Santa Barbara and her colleagues have been studying a group of molecules known as reflectins, which are found inside various types of squid. And these are the molecules that are used, that the squid use to camouflage themselves so that they can't be seen.
So what types of squid are we talking about here?
So they were originally characterised in Hawaiian bobtail squid, but only certain species of squid, including the longfin inshore squid, have an ability to control when these reflectins, as they're known, are switched on and off.
So what are these reflectins and how do they go about making squid iridescent?
So reflectins are a positively charged protein, and normally they'd be held apart by electrostatic forces with the positive charges repulsing each other. But what they found was that the iridescence was mediated by acetylcholine. And what happens is that the neurotransmitter acetylcholine causes them to become decorated with phosphates, and these phosphates are negatively charged, so that once the charges are neutralized, they can agglomerate together and become organized in the cell. And this then leads to the iridescence that helps the squid keep themselves hidden from their predators.
So now that the scientists understand how this works, what are the possible applications for this?
Well, seeing a squid use this to hide from their predators, you could imagine military applications whereby you would try to create paints that you could switch a camouflaging effect on or off, or maybe even sort of in spy cars and creating, creating the paints of the future for the next James Bond car.
So understanding how squid protect themselves from their predators could help us create our own camouflage technology. Thanks, Matt. Now, last month saw the announcement of this year's Nobel Prize winners. And the Chemistry Award went to Tom Steitz, Ada Yonath and Venkatraman Ramakrishnan for their work on the structure and function of the ribosome. And I had the pleasure of speaking to Tom Steitz from Yale University in the United States to find out just why his work on the ribosome was so important.
Well, every cell requires ribosomes. Without it, a cell can't survive. The ribosome takes the messenger RNA that has been made by RNA polymerase from the genes encoded in DNA, and it translates the messenger RNA into proteins. So all the proteins, well, almost all the proteins in the cell, are made by the ribosome.
And so how did you go about finding the structure of this ribosome? So what methods did you use, and how did that help you visualize what it looks like?
Well, we used a method called X-ray crystallography. What we need to do this is we need a crystal, and the crystal that we used was pioneered by Ada Yonath, who co-shared this prize. And with these crystals, it is possible to get the atomic structure. You put the crystal in front of an X-ray beam, and in this case, it has to be a very intense X-ray beam. Indeed, we have to use synchrotron radiation. And then the X-rays are diffracted off the crystal and give what's called reflections. They're spots that have different intensities. And these hundreds of thousands of diffraction spots are recorded by a detector, and then a lot of computing goes on after that.
In terms of the different molecules and structures that you can visualize using X-ray crystallography, the ribosome, I believe, is actually quite a large structure. So did it involve quite a few different visualizations that were then pieced together to realize what the overall structure was?
Well, the ribosome, the large subunit which we worked on, is about 1.6 million molecular weight. It's about nearly 10 times larger than the previously largest molecule structure that was determined. The advantage of protein or macromolecular crystallography is you can look at anything, really. I always tell my students that if you could make a mouse hold still, I'm sure you could crystallize it and solve its structure. In any case, you can look at very, very large assemblies using X-ray crystallography.
Now, as a result of this work, though, quite a lot of important scientific developments happened and stemmed from it. For example, the fact that a generation of antibiotics was born from this. So how was this information able to help drug design and, antibiotic design thereafter?
What we did was we made complexes with the existing antibiotics, that mostly the ones that bind near the peptidyl transferase center. And there are many categories of antibiotics. And what you can then notice is there are different families of antibiotics that bind very close to each other. The ribosome is extremely similar among all organisms, amazingly similar given its age. However, fortunately, there are some differences between human or eukaryotic ribosomes and the eubacterial ribosomes, and those are the regions that are targeted by the antibiotics that can be pharmaceuticals. I mean, obviously, you want to kill the bacteria, but not the host. So we could see where those differences lie.
Just lastly, how do you feel about being given the Nobel Prize for Chemistry?
I'm sort of overwhelmed. It's great, but the really exciting part for me was the days we were able to peer into the center of the ribosome and see this amazing structure that we had no idea what it was going to look like.
A true chemist there, Tom Stites from Yale University, whose real enjoyment came from his scientific finding rather than his Nobel Prize. Now, Tom's findings were made possible thanks to the technology of X-ray crystallography, which allowed Tom and his colleagues to visualise the ribosomal structure and analyse its function. And another scientist who's also used this technique for many years and whose work led to the first really effective treatment against HIV is Tom Blundell from the University of Cambridge, whose work understanding the structure of HIV proteases, enzymes that are vital to the life cycle of HIV, led to the production of protease inhibitors to fight the infection. So I met Tom to discuss this research and find out what new work it led on to.
Well, we realised that HIV had an enzyme which processes the virus, allows it to mature. We identified that. We characterised it in the lab. It was one of the first genomes we knew completely HIV. So we were able to express the protein in the laboratory, define its architecture, and then use that information to target small molecules. And that moved very quickly in the 80s, so that in the 90s, we had the first AIDS antivirals. Of course, there was a big problem with resistance, but these drugs have been very useful in keeping people alive.
Now, when you say you were able to define the structure of this protease, what exactly was the structure that you then found, which then made drug targets possible?
Well, it was fascinating because, as we predicted, it looked like the ancestor of some other molecules we've been studying. And so we were able to use that architecture to take the drugs we've been developing before and move them very quickly into HIV proteinase as a target.
But how did this method actually help you to visualise what this protease looked like and therefore know where to target?
Well, the architecture turned out to have a very well-defined active site where the enzyme processes and matures the virus proteins. And this looked to us to be a very good binding site for small molecules. It had pockets which we could explore with chemistry and use to get a selective drug molecule candidate.
You've gone on from this finding now to try and use X-ray crystallography to try and create drug targets or find possibilities for cancer and also tuberculosis.
Well, what we did in the 80s was to use the architecture to refine and optimise a molecule which started off with the natural substrate. But what we've been able to do over the last 10 years is to use our knowledge of genomics to characterise targets which are important for cancer in the human and important for TB in the bacterium.
What kind of enzymes do you target that will actually lead to a reduction, say, of a tumour or help relieve symptoms of tuberculosis?
Well, in cancer, it's quite challenging. So we choose enzymes that are important in regulating the growth of the tumour. And we know quite a lot about the signaling and regulatory pathways in the cell. With TB, it's much more difficult, although, of course, we have many less genes and therefore proteins in TB. But TB can hibernate. It's got a terrible thick wall. It's very difficult to get things in. And that's the challenge there.
Tom Blundell from the University of Cambridge, explaining how the use of X-ray crystallography has led to greater insight and development in the field of drug discovery, for both antibiotics, as Tom Stites mentioned earlier, and for his own work on HIV, cancer and tuberculosis. You're listening to Chemistry World with me, Meera Senthilingam. And still to come, we discover the potential secret to eternal life, how to manipulate proteins to help you find diseases, and how scientists have created the thinnest nanowires yet. But first, we go out to the moon, where it's pretty certain now that water exists there. Isn't that right, Nina?
Indeed. So these three studies, which have been published in the same issue of Science magazine, there have been three studies from three different spacecraft that have gone near to the moon's surface. So all three of these have found strong evidence for water on the moon's surface by looking at the infrared absorptions.
So how does looking at infrared let you know that water is present?
If you see an absorption in the area of around about 3 micrometres, this is an indication of an OH bond, which could be either hydroxy or water.
What are the three spacecrafts that have been providing information on this?
So the first one was an Indian spacecraft, and it went round the moon in late 2008, and it was looking at the possible presence of water close to the lunar poles. And after it had found the absorptions around about 3 micrometres, some of the scientists that were involved in that study went back to look at some earlier data that was taken in 1999 on the Cassini spacecraft. And again, they found the absorptions that would suggest that water was present. And then the scientists in the first study approached Jessica Sunshine, who was involved in a flyby of the moon more recently in June 2009, and suggested that Jessica Sunshine's team looked for the same IR bond. So the final team found IR absorptions, which verified the earlier results.
So you've got three pieces of evidence here confirming that there's water on the moon, essentially. But how much water are we looking at here?
We're looking at really quite a tiny amount of water, which equates to less than in the soil of a hottest desert on Earth. And to put it more simply, if you take 1 cubic metre of lunar soil and you squeeze out all the water in it, you'll only get 1 litre of water. So there is some water, but not a huge amount, but possibly enough if we were considering putting manned bases on the moon to astronauts to get their water source from there.
Now, how is it thought this water formed?
Well, the third team were looking at the daily patterns of water within the moon and found that the formation and retention of water was a continuous process. And this adds weight to the solar wind theory, which is just one of the theories as to why there may be water on the moon.
And what's this theory?
The theory suggests that the hydrogen ions in the wind, as they bang into the rocks on the moon's surface, liberate oxygen from them in the form of water.
And so now, knowing that this water is on there, or but just a small amount, what can then be done to potentially improve the life for astronauts travelling out there?
Well, if somebody can come up with a clever way of extracting this and store the water, then there is potential for a manned base on the moon.
And from new discoveries on the moon to new discoveries here on Earth, Anna, as a potentially new element's been formed.
Yes, the latest potential addition to the periodic table is element number 114. So Heino Nietzsche and a team from the University of California at Berkeley spent 8 days smashing a high-energy beam of calcium-48 ions into a plutonium-242 target, and they managed to detect 2 nuclei of element 114.
Why is it called element 114?
Calcium-48 has 8 extra neutrons compared to the most abundant isotope of calcium, calcium-40. So when a calcium-48 nucleus collides with a plutonium-242 nucleus, there's a small chance that the nuclei will fuse to create a compound nucleus with 114 protons.
And so what type of element is this?
It's a super heavy element, and it is relatively unstable, but it's one of a sort of drip feed of super heavy elements that are being sort of discovered and confirmed and hopefully added to the periodic table.
So it's a fairly recent discovery, and I imagine it must be quite a long process before it's actually confirmed as an official element.
It is. Well, the original discovery by the Russian team was over a decade ago, and it takes quite a lot of jumping through hoops before IUPAC, the International Union of Pure and Applied Chemistry, will officially recognise an element and allow it to be added to the periodic table. So it still could be quite some time before we actually see it added as its own box on the periodic table.
So although it could be a while before it's official, it's good to hear that elements such as 114 are still being found today, particularly adding to the group of super heavy elements. Thanks, Anna. Imagine if we could redesign nature and manipulate perhaps the proteins of nature to do exactly what we want them to do. Now, nature is obviously impressive in its own right, with years of evolution fine-tuning it. But if you could learn from these improvements and make a few adjustments on the molecular level, well then, you enter the field of synthetic biology. And one scientist working in this area, with the hope of diagnosing diseases such as multiple sclerosis at earlier stages, is Ben Davis from the University of Oxford. And I spoke to Ben to find out how his team are working on this.
We're using, in many cases, chemistry to make and break bonds, to manipulate biomolecules and create novel biomolecules. So proteins that are artificial and haven't existed before, for example, or to create little constructs that might be considered to be things that look a bit like artificial cells. And both of those are two examples of things that you could say are an artificial or a synthetic form of biology.
So what proteins have you been looking into and changing and manipulating to find out about, say, diseases, for example?
We're trying to develop chemistries that could be applied in principle to almost any protein. So one of the ideas that we like to play with is the idea that we could take a generic scaffold, a shape of protein that is found quite widely in nature, and then decorate it in a way to give it lots of different functions according to what you want it to do. And one of the scaffolds we've looked at is one that's referred to as a tin barrel. It's this beautiful sort of barrel-like structure that is found in almost 10% of all known protein structures. And then we've dropped things onto it. We've played with the structure. We've played with the function using largely chemical methods rather than sort of more traditional genetic or biological methods.
So what do you actually attach to them? So what kind of groups are you attaching and how are they then changing the functions of the protein?
It's almost an unlimited variety of things that we can attach in principle. And so there are lots of different games we could play and lots of things we could investigate. Just to give you a specific example, we wanted a couple of years ago to build a protein that was a mimic of one that occurs naturally in the body. It's one that has a slightly obscure acronym of PSGL1, a bit of a boring acronym. But this protein is far from boring. In fact, it's decorating the surface of many white blood cells, and it's this protein that really helps white blood cells find their way to sites of infection and sites of inflammation. So what we thought was, if we can make something that behaves like this protein, we could use an artificial variant of this protein to find in disease states places where there might be infection or there might be inflammation. So we built an artificial variant, and we attached onto it two very specific modifications that look like bits of the natural human protein. One is a sugar, and one is another modification called sulfur tyrosine. So we strapped these two modifications on with chemistry, adjusted their position, and when we take our artificial protein, it turns out that if we get the positioning right of those two groups, our artificial protein can be put into disease models and can track down sites of inflammation, sites of disease, by using the same mechanism that white blood cells use to get to their path. So white blood cells grab hold of certain cell types that line blood vessels when these cell types are changed. Our protein behaves like a protein found on white blood cells, and so sort of mimics the pathway that white blood cells take by taking the same route. And we've used that in models of things like multiple sclerosis and cerebral malaria and things like that.
How would you go about actually, say, inserting this protein into people that you want to find the locations of disease in? And then how would you actually identify where the disease is?
The artificial protein itself can be put into in vivo models, and we can put it into bloodstream, and it flows from the bloodstream and then just binds to certain blood vessels that happen to be near the sites of disease. One of the things we've developed has been to try and convert this idea into a sort of technology that might be used in hospitals quite widely. And the technology we've been looking at is MRI, magnetic resonance imaging. And there are MRI scanners in most hospitals these days. So we've created little particles that behave in a very similar way and again, use the same pathway. And so that's an example of how thinking about the biology has led us towards a biotechnology.
What range of diseases could this be used as a diagnostic tool then?
The process we're looking at is a fundamental part of the innate immune response. That means it's found in a whole range of different species, mammalian species, very much in humans. And this type of innate immune response is actually a hallmark of pathology, of the breakdown that's caused by disease in a whole range of different diseases. Many diseases start off by triggering some form of inflammatory response. And we could go in with our particles and see that at really early stages. So it turns out that we can apply it to diseases like multiple sclerosis, which are really difficult often to see. Similarly, we have some really good evidence that this can also be applied to things like brain metastases. So when you have secondary tumors in the brain, they can often be very small and very difficult to visualize, but will be associated with inflammation. And again, this innate immune response.
If it picks up these initial innate responses, how are you able to specify which disease is causing this inflammation? Like how is it able to pick up and know that it's, say, multiple sclerosis or it's a tumor?
One of the things you have to remember, that current MRI doesn't have any molecular information at all. It's just done on contrast, just really a picture. And very skilled technicians look at an MRI picture and go, oh, that might be that's a blob. And there might be a blob from this and a blob from that. Ours is sort of is the next step on, where we have a molecular basis for our interaction that tells us that it's about innate immune response, it's about inflammation, that could come from, as you point out, four or five different diseases. The next step to that, though, is to look at the shape, to look at the location and tissue dependence. And that can often tell you very quickly that it's likely to be one of three diseases. And then the next step on in the work that we're doing is to combine it with other particles. So we'd have a particle that detects this innate immune response. We have a second particle that comes in against another biomarker. And when you see the combination of effects, you can say, aha. And you can imagine that one day we hope that doctors will have access to 10, 20, even 100 different particles, each of which is smart enough to pick out aspects of a lesion and tell them, okay, particle 4 and particle 26 bind, therefore it's probably this disease.
So it may be possible for doctors to fine-tune their search for diseases and diagnose them earlier, which for diseases such as multiple sclerosis and also tumour formation will make an incredible difference to treatment and even prevention. For our final news roundup this month, we go down to the nano level, where scientists have made the thinnest nanowires yet. Nina?
Indeed, Japanese researchers have been growing ultra-thin metal wires within carbon nanotubes for applications such as nanoelectronic devices, because they've found out that these metal wires have novel electronic properties. So because these metal wires are only one atom thick, if you try and grow them on their own, there's problems such as they're really fragile and they oxidise really easily. So this group have found that if you grow them within protective carbon nanotubes, their properties can be easily measured and mapped.
So which team have been looking into this, and how did they go about creating nanowires with carbon nanotubes around them?
The team are based at Nagoya University in Japan, and the way to make it really simple, they just take carbon nanotubes and metal powder and they heat them to 500 to 600 degrees C, and the vaporised metal atoms just fill up the hollow centres in the centre of the carbon nanotubes and solidify, and they fill up to about 90% capacity.
And have they been able to make a variety of nanowires?
Yeah, they've been able to vary the thickness of the wires by varying the diameter of the hole within the carbon nanotubes. So far they've been able to do it on two different metals, europium and ytterbium, and they think they should be able to do it on other metals with low sublimation temperatures, such as potassium, calcium and strontium.
Now, the fact that these wires are coated in the carbon nanotubes, is this going to prohibit the activity of the wires at all? And then, so are the scientists going to have to look into taking these carbon nanotubes off again once the wires are formed?
So far, the carbon nanotubes don't seem to be affecting the properties of the wires at all, but the team do think that they are going to need to look into removing the carbon nanotube, and there are concerns about its stability once removed.
And so now that they've accomplished this, so they've found that they can make these super thin nanowires, what are they going to do next and what potential applications will this have?
Well, as well as trying to remove the wires from the nanotube, they're also going to start looking at the different metals that we mentioned earlier and see if these can find different uses within nanoelectronic devices.
And well, from improving nanotechnology to potentially improving or making it last longer anyway, and that's human life. Now, Matt, scientists have been looking into the secret of a longer life.
Indeed, Mira. Frank Medea from the University of Graz in Austria and his colleagues have shown that a molecule called spermidine can actually increase the life of cells and indeed animals just simply by feeding them this molecule.
So what is spermidine?
Well, spermidine's a really simple molecule. It's basically a propylamine and a butylamine linked together by a secondary amine group. So you've got a 4-carbon chain and a 3-carbon chain with a nitrogen in the middle and an NH2 on each end.
And where is spermidine found?
Well, that's one of the interesting things. It's found in very high levels in grapefruit and also in sperm.
So how have scientists gone about using grapefruit and sperm to then see how human life can be made longer with this molecule?
Well, the molecule is actually also found in cells themselves. Basically, what they've done is they've been feeding spermidine itself in cell culture and also in feed to both yeast cells, human immune cells, and various other organisms such as fruit flies, and shown that actually all of these live longer when they've had a diet rich in spermidine. So, for instance, yeast will live 3 or 4 times longer, human immune cells 30% longer, and fruit flies and nematode worms also live around 30% longer just when they're fed a diet rich in spermidine.
And how is it thought that spermidine has this effect?
Well, basically it seems that spermidine has a role to play in a mechanism known as autophagy, which is the way that cells clean up the waste that accumulates as they get older. And as cells get older, the levels of spermidine inside them drop, which seems to then lead to cell death, or plays a part in cell death. So by keeping cells able to clean themselves up for longer, they're then able to stay alive for that little bit longer as well.
And so, knowing this information now, is this the secret to a longer life? Should people be eating more grapefruits and increasing their sexual activity?
Well, Maddeo did have a bit of a laugh with that when he was speaking to Chemistry World. He was very cautious about saying that he'd found the elixir to eternal life. But he did say that people could try to stay young by eating a lot of grapefruit and having a lot of sex. He said it might not work, but he didn't think it would do much harm.
Yes, it really wouldn't do much harm at all, would it? Thanks, Matt. Now, that's pretty much it for this month. But before we go, it's time to catch up with the answer to last month's chemical conundrum. So what was last month's question, Matt?
Well, last month we were asking about the chemistry of bread making. We're talking about a compound called L-cysteine, which is often added to dough to speed up the rising process when you're making bread. Now, until 2001, when a synthetic route to L-cysteine was finally discovered, the molecule came from quite an intriguing source, and we wanted you to tell us what that was.
And Nina, what was it?
The answer is human hair, and the lucky winner is Mike Ikem from Nairobi.
And so what have you got for this month's conundrum?
This month we're going to stick with the subject of Nobel Prizes from earlier on in the podcast, and we want to know the name of the acid that was used to dissolve the gold Nobel Prize medals of Max von Laue and James Franck so they could be hidden and the metal kept safe during the Second World War. If you think you know the answer, send us an email to chemistryworld@rsc.org and don't forget to include your name and address.
And you can, of course, use that address to send us your thoughts, feedback or suggestions for future episodes. That's it for this month, but join us next month for more of the top stories from the world of chemistry. Contributors this month were Nina Notman, Matt Wilkinson and Anna Lucock, as well as our guests Tom Stites, Tom Blundell and Ben Davis. I'm Meera Senthilingam from thenakedscientist.com, and I'll see you next month.
The Chemistry World podcast is brought to you by the Royal Society of Chemistry. Look us up online at chemistryworld.org.